Hey, Bob. This is Scott Woods, rockcritics.com. It's Sunday, November 15th. Bob Dobbs and I are having the second of our chats about rock criticism, the history of rock criticism, and some of the ideas of rock criticism, the problems of rock criticism, I guess you might say. How you doing, Bob?
Excellent, Scott. I enjoyed the presentation on rock critics that you laid out. Nice intro. Looking forward to more.
Excellent. So, there was obviously a lot we sort of started to go into on the first conversation and a lot of lift-off points, but I think to maybe try and corral this one in just slightly, at least for starters, I think it would make sense to maybe start off with Richard Meltzer because, you know, we kind of keep coming back to him, and he's obviously pretty central to this discussion. So what I was going to do is just kind of start off by saying, sort of letting you know where I'm coming at with Richard Meltzer, where I'm coming from, rather. I've got kind of a short list of sort of the reasons why I'm kind of so interested in and fascinated by the aesthetics of rock and why it's kind of such a touchstone piece of rock criticism for me. So, number one, I think with that book, he basically invents rock criticism. It's not necessarily the first book of rock criticism, but it's probably the first truly intellectual study of the music. Number two, I think it's really interesting how he pronounces right on page one of the book the futility of saying anything new, even though, at least within the genre of rock criticism, no one else has said anything remotely close to that, and I still don't think anyone has really caught up to his book in that regard.
Wait a minute. He says, this is not the preface, he says on page one that anything that he could say but rock has already been said? Is that what he means by no new?
I think that's my interpretation, because I'll go into that a bit, but
okay. He
even by quoting Surfing Bird, I think that's kind of ultimately what he's saying. And his very first, his very first sentence is, this is a sequel. But we'll go into that.
Yeah.
I'll talk a little bit about the Surfing Bird thing.
Yes.
Also, I think the other interesting thing about it is, I just called it like the first sort of really intellectual, sort of in-depth intellectual rock piece of rock criticism. But he's already sort of parodying the form that hadn't even kind of come into its own yet. Now, you know, there's probably, I guess, that's where I guess maybe the McLuhan sort of Joyce angle comes in, that it's a new thing within rock, but, you know, certainly it's not a new thing. But it just, there's just something really interesting how he's kind of writing rock criticism almost from the perspective of it's already happened. Like, the music's kind of already over, and there's nowhere else to take the form of rock criticism itself. And yet, when he's writing it, no one has really done any of it yet, so it sets up a weird kind of course of action for the genre, I guess.
Yes.
I like the way also, number four, he really messes around with the form and with the language, much more so than any other book of rock criticism I can think of. It's kind of like a real labyrinth of meaning and execution, and it's difficult. It's the first time I read it, I probably absorbed like maybe 10-15% of it, but something kind of compelled me to plow through the thing. Number five, I just think it's a complete anomaly within the world of rock criticism, in that it's a book that, you know, it's cited by a lot of other rock critics. It, you know, often gets called both the best and or the worst book in rock criticism, but like hardly anyone has ever really kind of like gone really in depth into reading it, I don't think. It's a book that gets kind of written about in really cliched ways, so no one kind of knows what to make of it, but everyone likes it, or they hate it.
Yeah, like McLuhan or Phineas Wake, same reaction.
Yeah, it's very similar in that way. And that was my next point. When I first read the book around 1987, I was aware of the book long before that, but in 86 was, I think, the year it was reissued with the Greil Marcus intro and all that. So that's when I first actually read the thing. And pretty much right away, I kind of thought, you know, there's something in this that's very McLuhan-like, and I read some McLuhan by that point, but I hadn't fully grasped that, obviously, either. But I could still sense that there's something very McLuhan-like going on in here, and why, like, why hasn't someone sort of mentioned this? Why, you know, why isn't this being brought up by Greil Marcus in his introduction? And I think finally, just it's interesting that he followed up this book with a book called Gulcher, Post-Rock Cultural Pluralism in America, in which he's already kind of declared that, you know, it's time to move onward, or I don't know if onward is the right way to put it, but like, rock does not contain the world anymore. The world is kind of, I don't know how to put it, it's just, rock is not going to, you know, rock is not the answer, clearly, and you're just as likely to find meaning in bottle caps or something like that. and that's in 72. And again, rock criticism itself is barely even off the ground at that point. So all these people are sort of continuing, like, you know, in his line and continuing to do the work, and I think continuing to do some great work. But he's, the guy who kind of originated the form is already like, it's over. So that's just, you know, sort of a bit of a list of, a grocery list of what kind of compels me to the book still. And like I say, I mean, it's definitely a major touchstone for me. So.
And it should be. His book gets it right, but he doesn't know really what he's doing. But he's channeling the accurate response. So if you accept my assumptions and concepts like tactility, then I may be the first to explain it. But you have to accept my definition of tactility. So the tactile is the interplay of the senses, not any particular sense. It's the part of the brain or organism that coheres the different sensory inputs, sight, sound, taste, smell, into what we experience as an integrated consciousness, right? All our senses are working. If we try to put our finger on something that is processing all that, and in the age of computers, when they came in, the idea of processing information gives you a handle, a concrete example of the function of tactility. When McLuhan said that television was an extension of central nervous system, central nervous system's all over the place. And that can be tactile, and he says it is tactile, but you can look at the computer as an extension of the functions of the brain, not just the central nervous system. You see what I'm saying? So the information processing aspect of the computers might be an easier way for people to understand the idea of tactility. They know there's something in there organizing the data in the computer. And if you think that's happening in the mind, I think it was John Lilly who started to write, one of the early people to write about the computer as its processing mechanism as a metaphor for consciousness. So if we establish tactility as not a particular sense, and it's the interplay of senses, the right. interplay, then the first pretty comprehensive medium that's tactile along those lines, first extension of tactility is television, because you can see, you can hear, there's movement, and people see colors or objects and they can smell them. It's more in their imagination, whatever, and I'm not going to, you know, decry people who can smell it, or those that can, people perceive differently. So there's kind of a synesthesia. Synesthesia is the mixing up of senses, but it's pretty comprehensive television, and that's what Joyce recognized. He knew that media development was going from the eye to the ear, through radio, to tactility. All right?
Okay.
And he probably got the concept of tactility from Thomas Aquinas when he was a young person educated by the Jesuits. And McLuhan thought that Thomism approximated the intuition of the common sense, the sensus communis, or tactility. So if we look at what is the content of television or the electric tactile extension, it's music, it's all kinds of things, movies, but definitely rock and roll came in, and it was a new kind of music. No one ever experienced it before. It wasn't jazz, and it was fast, it was instantaneous, and it was pretty instinctive. I would say that that rock and roll was taking mechanical rhythms, the rhythms of the cities and the cityscapes and the factories, the mechanical environment, and pushing it towards some kind of tangibility in software terms or in tactile terms. So if you accept that rock and roll is the acoustic attempt to mime tactility, then you see in what Melcher writes the exact description of that, but he doesn't know it's the tactile sense. But he's playing with polarities and concepts and juggling them to show it's more than that. And he comes up with this great concept, the unknown tongue.
Right, right.
And that is another way of saying tactility, because the tongue is the mouth, and that's orality. But if it's unknown, there's more than the tongue. It's almost like if you could look at the brain processing information coming in and watching it organize the tongue to say stuff.
Right?
Right. Think of that tactile level. That's what rock, electrified music, gropes towards to express tactility. And because there are no boundaries, it'll go soft, loud, all over the place. And ripe for, you know, 10 years later, psychedelic sculpting of sound, feedback. All attempts to move sound beyond just being an ear experience moves into the kinetic. That brings in the dancing, moves it into drinking and poetry being spouted off like in the jazz sessions. You see, the beatniks were the first rudimentary grasping at tactility when they thought, well, okay, I write poetry, but it's got to have some other senses in it. So I'll go in a club and have somebody play music behind me. You know what I mean? They were starting to look, but because they were literate people, sophisticated people, they weren't, well, pop music wasn't even around. It was, well, rock, jazz started to happen when the beatniks happened, but they're thinking of jazz as the equal to their intellectual probings, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
What threw them off, or the jazz beatniks probably were thrown by the tactile thing they were groping for and didn't see what rock was doing. I mean, I don't know. I think a lot of the Beatniks, Ginsburg, then they might have liked rock and roll when Dylan showed up. But see, Dylan had verbal content thrown in, and that made it a little more than Bobby Darin, right?
Yeah. Well, what's so interesting about that, and I'll make this really brief because I don't want to cut in, but it's always fascinated me, and there's been some writing on the internet about this recently, how why wasn't there a rock criticism for Elvis and Buddy Holly? Like, you know, there was no legitimate actual attempt to put into words what this music actually meant. It really didn't happen until the Beatles. But I've always been kind of fascinated by that, and it's neat you're saying that the beatniks, they didn't kind of grasp that rock might have been where it's at, and it was still very much in the bebop sort of movement or mode or whatever. So,
yeah.
And if, go on.
Yeah, they don't have to say rock is where it's at. They didn't understand its technical qualities. The guy who did was McLuhan. He's writing about Elvis and that stuff in the 50s as soon as it happens, in a larger context. So I want to go into, another aspect I should say, is when the satellite environment came around the planet in the 60s, that's a new environment. It's invisible, its effects, so you start noticing the older environment. So TV starts getting noticed in the 60s as an environment, even though it's obsolete because the satellite is the real hidden ground. And that's why live TV was stopped. They cut off live TV. They said, no, this is too potent. And so they made it canned TV. That's in the mid-60s. So that's a recognition that television is having a big effect on people, but it was too late. It already happened in the 50s. And because it was an invisible environment, nothing around it, going around it like the later satellites, then you did not know you were swimming in the tactile effect of television, and therefore you wouldn't get the tactile qualities of rock. See, that's why no one could talk about it other than McLuhan, certainly not rock criticism, because of television / music, rock and roll, was an invisible environment.
Right, okay.
I mean, it's interesting when you go back and you hear, I think I've seen Zappa refer to it in interviews. Everybody thought it was going to be a fad. You know, rock was like the pet rock, or the hula hoop would come and go. And
yeah,
then everybody would regain their senses and go back to the symphony orchestra or something. I don't know where they managed they'd go, but they didn't understand that the rock was a medicinal response to the felt need in the population, which had been tactilized by the television environment. And as long
funny,
as...
Cause I was just going to say, even the Beatles said that about themselves. that they were a fad, and you know, one of the funny quotes, one of them is going to go back to hairdressing or something like that, and they expected it all be over in 2-3 years or something.
Well, it's true for the band members, but the function of rock and roll and rock does not stop.
Right.
It didn't matter. That's why Paola came in. I mean, it didn't matter who was on. Any teenager singing would have been a hit. So therefore, since anybody could do it, then the mafia and the Paola guys controlled it for their buddies. But anybody got on there could have been a hit. See, and that confused people. Like, where's the expertise, the old literate, hierarchical sense of craftsmanship? But the point is that the music, of the tactile qualities, the beat, the speed up of rock and rock and roll was necessary to fill in the tactile experience people had. In other words, each sense had to step into hyper mode. You had to have a, you're going to have a change in music, a change in literature, a change in newspapers, magazine, and movies, and sports. All this would change, and this is what McClellan was saying, very quickly, because you have a new medium. So rock is just a symptom of this larger effect, among other things. But because we're moving to a tactile environment, and I quoted last week, I think, that music becomes a private concern, the kids really identify with the ear. And they think rock is ear. It ain't ear.
Right.
Okay, so you go into this idea of the unknown tongue. It's really important. And there is the term phatic communication. I think you've heard me mention it before.
Yeah, yeah.
And the phatic is defined in the dictionary as general sociability. I use the example of when you're at work and someone says, how are you doing? You don't stop and tell them verbally how you're doing. You just nod, say, I'm okay, how are you doing? And you don't wait for them to tell you how you're doing. So the meaning of the question, how are you doing, is not to be taken literally. It's just a way of verbally touching or patting someone on the back or shaking their hand. The content's not relevant. When you get into a tactile society with television, then there's no content that has any staying power or has any focus, so you determine its meaning. And the best music for that turns out to be, the best phatic response musically is rock and roll. Now let's go into some quotes to illustrate this. So I'm looking at the section you sent me, which is really good, on the unknown tongue,
yeah.
Page 112 of the Aesthetics of Rock. Is that the 1986 edition?
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to take a bunch of different quotes on the unknown tongue. Let's try this. Schematize, page 119. Schematize.
Okay, yeah.
The unknown tongue experience has precisely four components. One, change, abrupt movement, sudden transition structurally and experientially. That's exactly how one would imagine the organism that is the tactility. If the tactile organism, whatever it is, that's organizing sensory input, it's like a catcher's mitt. It's a catcher. It's catching all this stuff coming in, and it's got to quickly orchestrate the ratios among them, all right, at the speed of way beyond thought, the speed of being.
Right.
And as it juggled these things and kept it coherent or worked out the ratios, it would be moving abruptly, suddenly, structurally, and experientially. I mean, that's incredible. These words are exactly describing tactility called the unknown tongue. Okay, change, abrupt movement. You notice he's trying to get more than one sense in there. Change, that could be kinetic change. Abrupt movement, that could be kinetic change. Sudden transition, that's like almost structurally, means like total instant, something instant.
Right.
And then to say experientially, every moment is different. You're not reading a book. You're not, you have to respond to the environment the rock is coming at you through the live radio. So it's changing you structurally and experientially immediately. So then point two, musical awe, I would call that what McClellan calls, when you're in a new environment, especially the electric environment, it's molding the population instantly. Everybody it has been turned to stone. They are in awe because there's no way, if you're a literate environment, to figure out what the hell's going on. You don't notice that when you don't conceptually think of the implications of when you're on the telephone and you're in two places at once. And how could that be? How could that, relate to your image that you're just here and talking to someone over there? You're in a state of perceptual hypnosis or somnambulism. So I don't know what he means by musical awe, but I'm taking the words musical awe and fitting into what I'm saying, right?
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And then he goes musical awe, and then he knows it's more than that. It's the awe of all the other senses, of the feet, of the smell, of the sight. So he then tries to figure out how to say that more than musical. Objectified awe, mere awe, odd self. It's totally accurate. That's how you would describe the multi-sensory movement of tactility. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You're laughing because you're learning. This makes total sense.
Yeah.
It's never been said before. It's the first time humanity's ever heard this explanation.
Yeah, no, this is awesome.
Yeah, not this is awesome. That's right. Taxonomic urgency. Taxonomy. That's the stuff the animal, right?
Right.
Unless it means something else. Oh, he has here. Note 109. Taxonomic urgency. You know, you just got to label it tongue, as in there's a tongue. You see, you got to look at. This could be interpreted as he is stoned. But if you think of people getting stoned in the 50s, 60s, they were trying to get all their senses loosened up, get a bit of synesthesia to approximate the tactile experience they were feeling technologically or technically in the TV environment. All right? And so the thing is, he doesn't have to be stoned. He might have been stoned to get tuned in, but there's nothing wrong with that, because you've got to approximate this very difficult water you're swimming in that you can't even really figure out what it is. And so he goes, you know, you just got to label it tongue, as in there's a tongue. It's like it's happening so fast, you just say, yeah, there goes, hey, that just went by. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's actually saying, it's like McLuhan when he described understanding media. I will grab anything to throw it into the pot. I will use any data, because to move at the whole pattern, you're not stuck. And you're actually, you're not stuck in trying to make a particular point, because it's phatic. You're not coming, you're not trying to be precise verbally, and you don't expect a precise verbal response or a detailed response. That's the problem when you're writing about rock. It's a phatic environment that doesn't require a response, but you're responding. And you're responding not just, the thing is, you're responding more than just your ear. You're responding to the mass emotion that's happening, because everybody's sharing the same space at the same time and the same music. And it's beating up the rhythms of your society, of your civilization, so rapidly that it's like it creates ecstasy. And let's see. So it's like if everybody was stoned, what would be, and they're all dancing, which happened many times. There is quick glimpses of your eye at someone else, catching someone else's eye, or watching someone's movement, or you're moving so someone doesn't hit you. Look at that rapid interaction using all your senses, and you're on your guard, and you're having a good time. You'd say things like, you just got a label. Hey, did you see that? That was something. Yeah, tongue. You know what I mean? It's just it's passing. This is what taxonomic urgency. You know, you just got a label of tongue, as in there's a tongue. Now, he's trying to say unknown tongue, so that's an interesting phrase, taxonomic urgency. It's almost like, this is killing me. I'm not able to really explain what's happened to me. In terms of communication, I've been killed. And stuff me. But there's a sense of urgency, because you can't close your ear lids. You don't have any ear lids.
Yeah.
Okay, so then 3 and 4, so taxonomic urgency, 3 and 4, taxonomic urgency, might be grouped as linking the fusion and confusion of the structural and the valuational with music most assuredly possess. No, sorry, I read that wrong. Might be grouped as linking the fusion and confusion of the structural and the valuational with objectivity variations in these elements. What a perfect description of, if you think of the eye as getting objectivity, the ear getting urgency and involvement, kinetic as the dancing and sudden transition of movement. Take those three factors. He's trying to say that. You're fused with the music, but it's confusion if you're trying to say what this means verbally. And what else? Of the structural and the valuational. The structural is the percept. The valuational is the concept. Both are mixed up with objectivity variations. Actually, you are seeing what you're doing. You know what's happening.
Right.
So you're going through conceptual, structural, conceptual, valuational, perceptual. That would be objectivity. All mixed up. This sentence, if you didn't have the framework of tactility as I'm defining it, this would make no sense, right?
Okay, yeah.
And yet, he is describing the rhythms. It make no sense. You wouldn't be able to translate it, but it would carry along, because some part of you would know that this is accurate. This is what's going on. But you couldn't stop and say what Meltzer was trying to say unless you had my language.
So, is there, like, I mean, this whole thing about the taxonomic urgency, you know, you just got to label it tongue, is, so he's, it's just odd to me that he's writing that down, but he's kind of, is it kind of also like saying that, like, why write it down? This makes no sense, or I can't, like, define this thing anyway, or am I getting that wrong? Or?
No, it's illiterate. I mean, a non-literate or post-literate, fully post-literate, or a semi-literate person wouldn't be compelled to write. But here's this guy who's taking English and philosophy and wants to be a writer. That's what a person born in the 40s is still seen to be legitimate to write as a profession. So,
right. Although he does insist in the early days that he didn't even think of what he was doing as writing.
That's right. He calls it visual.
Like recording almost or something.
But here's the point. He doesn't recognize that is his literate bias. He doesn't know that writing is, and reading and being visual and being literate is the American gene meme. It's the Gurdjieff's chief feature. The West is based on visual space. So you throw these literate kids growing up in the 40s before television, it's a pretty eye-based environment, even though you got radio movies, but it's still the rigid classrooms, rigid industrialism, very linear. Suddenly thrown into tactile environment, they are actually going to go into panic, there's the taxonomic urgency, and grab for their fundamental sensory bias to prop themselves up. You see, it's a kind of fundamentalism of your own culture. Okay, I hear this experience. The only meaningful way, because I cannot handle a phatic environment, because I'm used to literate meaning in terms of a significant experience, because I think we got to pin it down, he starts madly writing to pin it down. You know, he thinks that's how you do it. I mean, if you bring, let's see, when that guy got Rodney King got beat up in 92,
right.
He comes out in the end, and it's the famous quote, well, can't we all just get along? Okay, that's an emotion of community. That's the what McLuhan called the generosity of the literate culture. They're all fragmented by literacy, but they know they have to stay uniform. And so he goes to a very sentimental expression, but it's so American. Why can't we just get along? Ignoring all the complexities of a hyper-communicational society, where that's a silly sentiment, but that's all he can do. He could only go to his core, quote, belief system.
Right.
So he says that. And so Melter responds saying, well, can't we write this down? What's going on? It must be writable.
Right.
We must translate into literate text. But he's not of Eliot's and Joyce's generation, who still believed in literature when they started off. That ain't going to hold after World War II. So Melcher knows that he can actually experience the new completed extended central nervous environment of television and know that the book is weak and sort of half-consciously say, no, it's not even being a book. That's not what I'm doing. But he is doing, because he says, I'm not writing, but I'm being visual. And that's the eye. And it's actually the movie visual. See, the Beatniks turned the movie and the radio into an art form in response to the television tactility.
What do you mean?
Well, movies and radios were the environment before television.
Right, right.
And movies were just what everybody drank, and radio was just what they drank. No big culture in there. That was still the time of poets and novelists and the great writers. Once you move into television environment, subconsciously you start to notice what you were not noticing before, the movie and radio, and you turn it into an art form. How did it become an art form? New wave cinema, the French auteur theory, all right? The French guys being outside of it started looking at movies as art forms and talking about the directors. The radio is the Beatniks recognizing that jazz is an archetypal experience. When something becomes archetypal, it's the past. But you're just nosing for the first time, and you can be avant-garde in nosing it first. So the Beatniks were the first to notice and archetypalize within the literary context of novelists and writers the radio experience, which was jazz.
Right, right, okay.
So, but see, Meltzer's the next generation. He, and we can find some quotes he talks about. He's right there. He's not your generation. He's born in the 40s, so he's still got jazz as that influence, archetypal influence, but he knows there's something new happening by 1964, 65, and he's trying to write something. He's trying to, and yet, he's trying to visualize, and I would say to visualize it, he's trying to turn it back into cinema, because for the TV generation, the visual is no longer the book so much, it's the next stage of visuality, the movie. So, as you read, Meltzer here, let's see if we can find some evidence that he's really talking about the cinematic, not puny writing.
Right, okay.
So, we move along here. He says, classical music most assuredly possesses the unknown tongue, in brackets, when heard by a contemporary rock ear. Good point. Not. It's not an unknown tongue or not tactilely at the time, you know, the 19th century. It is
right.
A necessary ear balance, acoustic space balance, to the hypervisuality of the alphabetic and literate and industrial environment. But now we can see, no, we're starting to notice, and he doesn't even know it, but he's saying it. He's saying there's something more in there than just the ear. There's the tactile. He's calling it the unknown tongue, and you can't know the tactile until you experience television and rock and roll, the contemporary rock ear.
Right.
I mean, a classical musician or jazz person would find this a totally ridiculous statement. What does this mean? Classical music most assuredly possesses the unknown tongue. That's, what, I don't know what he's talking about. And when heard by us 20-year-olds. Can you just, Ed Leonard Bernstein, anybody, John Casey, wouldn't understand what's going on, you know?
Yeah.
Zappa might. Anyways, classical music, it's interesting how Meltzer is skittish about Zappa. Doesn't want to give him too much credit.
Skittish is exactly the word, and I've got some points to make about that.
So yeah, that's something we're going to do before we finish the series.
There's a lot to read into what he says about Zappa, I think. So
that's right.
Go on.
The relationship between the polarity between Zappa and Meltzer is going to be very important, right?
Yeah, no, I agree.
You got that, Ben? Very important, Ben Watson.
Are you listening, Ben?
Yeah. Okay, so he says, classical music most assuredly possesses the unknown tongue, and undoubtedly has also classified it and schematized its emergence. Now, what the heck does he mean by that when he's saying when heard by a contemporary rock ear? He's almost saying they've classified it, but they didn't know they were doing it, or they didn't appreciate it. So I'm not sure about that part. Maybe he clarifies the next sentence. Jazz pianist Thelonious Monk's Ruby My Dear contains several manifest tongues. Now think of Finnegan's Wake. Finney's Wake has 60 tongues on each page, right?
Yeah.
So jazz, this particular Ruby My Dear, contains several manifest tongues which result consciously, creatively, or mechanically, or inadvertently, as he meanders around the keyboard. You see, when you're in a tactile environment, anything can be on the air. Anything will fascinate you because the medium hypnotizes you. So is Monk, is he playing the piano with, you know, traditional literate creativity or mechanically or inadvertently? That's another way of saying he's playing it semi-phatically.
Right, okay.
So he's seeing that, to him, Monk is approximating the tactile level of rock, you know what I mean, by his sort of in detachment in the way he's playing. Then he says, even the final portion of the Star-Spangled Banner has been played with an unknown tongue. Now, because Meltzer is not accurate about what he really means, in my terms, he doesn't really know, can't articulate what the unknown tongue is, so he's going to make mistakes in trying to pin it down, which is okay within a phatic environment. The mistake is included. That's
right.
That's Duchamp's chance. Duchamp and those guys picking up on the intuiting the tactile and saying, yes, the chance part is relevant. So this sentence, classical, some of these sentences, I would say, unless I got him here and he told me exactly what he meant and then I could figure out what he meant, then it might be accurate. But some of these are going to be wrong. You know what I mean? It's not.
Yeah.
It's wrong in terms if you accept my conclusion about the tactility. So,
right.
But only, okay, even the final portion has been played with an unknown tongue. Okay, that's some kind of release mechanism in that song. I don't even know what it is he's referring to. I don't know the music that well.
He doesn't develop it, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. He puts a but, and he's always pointing the butt in. There's something extra about rock. Well, see, that's the extended tactility that rock is within the TV environment. That's what he's trying to get at. But only in rock and roll is the unknown tongue the natural, logical outcome of development. What is that development? The TV environment. But he doesn't know it. But he feels it. He knows it's the logical development of now, right?
Yeah.
And he's saying it 10 years later when rock, in a way, well, it's going to change within a year or so again into psychedelic music. You know what I mean?
It's.
And he's talking about the past. He's recognizing, intuiting what the dynamics in the 50s and early 60s were, because we're actually rapidly moving out of that. So, but only rock and roll is the unknown tongue, the natural logical outcome of development. And, you know, I know if anybody who doesn't know my stuff is listening to me, I'm sounding as crazy as Meltzer, right? But it's not as, it's more limited what I'm saying. I'm staying within a few terms of jargon, right? So you actually could get it. And you know a bit of my stuff, so you can get it. So I'm good I'm saying this to you. It only in rock does the tongue define its own importance self-referentially. Now look at that. Remember, when you, with television, it's the first time you could see a head. When you watch a television, that's a head looking back at you.
Right.
You know, the head looks around and sees things. That's what the camera picks up. And so immediately you have a weird self-consciousness in the TV environment. You're looking at your head lopped off looking back at you. Or at least the mechanism of tactile consciousness is what a TV screen is. You know, we call it the live camera pickup. So we're going to go meta, self-referential immediately. So he says, only in rock does the tongue define its own importance self-referentially. It's almost like music in the ear and rock is self-conscious because it knows it's only one part of the whole spectrum of technological hedonism that everybody's enjoying in the multi-hyper volume of the global theater. Get a bit of that?
Yep, yep.
Okay. Because music, I mean, you listen to music while you're watching a movie and while you're driving down the car. You got all kinds of other machines you're interacting with while listening to rock. And rock is the only one that can keep up with the whole interplay of all these different sensory experiences that are in your technologies, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Thus, although schematizable, tongue manipulation is not fully reducible mechanically to classical simples. That means you can't say what it is in an emphatic sense. You can't fit it back into literary categories.
Right, right.
But he's trying to, because that's what he is. He's a literate person. This concreteness, I was just thinking, what would happen if an African, growing up in 1965, had heard a little Beatles or something, and they were educated enough that they could read English. What would they think of this? See, what would be interesting to see what an African thought of this. Maybe it would make sense to them, you know? But they'd have to be pretty sophisticated in the sense they understood English. You know what I mean?
Well, what do you mean? Like, what would they think? Like,
it's a whole different culture. Here, it's almost like you couldn't find out. If you had an African that could understand this and read English, they'd have to be literate, and therefore they're not the pre-literate African.
Ah, okay. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering if we could get a tactile person, a more tactile culture. How would they take this conceptual interpretation? I don't think it could be done. This is only for literate people.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, go on.
Yeah, thus, although schematizable, tongue manipulation is not fully reducible mechanically to classical simples. This concreteness must contain within it an aura of concrete mystery. In other words, you can't get the whole thing down because it's not just visual. Almost a pop purposiveness without purpose. Ah, phatic. By mere designation. You see, when I read this, you know, a few weeks ago, a month ago, hadn't looked at it in 30 years, 40 years, I said, man, this is so obvious. And I knew nobody would get what I saw in it. But just me, I could go on like that. If you follow me, it makes total sense. He's trying to describe tactility, trying to put it back in literate terms, but constantly canceling the literate medium. He's stuck doing it because he knows it doesn't work that way.
Right.
He says, this concreteness, me trying to find classical symbols or words to say what this is, must contain with it an aura of concrete mystery. In other words, the unknown part, the unvisual, the interplay of immediate experience, change. I must also communicate change, abrupt movement, sudden transition, structurally, experientially. And you can't do that unless you write like Finnegan's Wake. That's the point. Finnegan's Wake is tactile rock in print. He doesn't know that. He's not old enough. He's not sophisticated enough to know how the first rock critic book was Finnegan's Wake.
Okay.
Because there are no units. As you analyze a sentence of Finnegan's Wake, he breaks it up into syllables, breaks the words up into syllables, and then into letters, and then into spaces or blanks. He breaks and he chops it up so that there's nothing there. And that's the only way you can visualize tactility. You hint, Joyce hints at meaning. You know, you look in there, you see the references and allusions, and you say some meaning, but then it's quickly canceled. Just like if you're playing music you're rock music, you're so tuned in, but at the same time it's kind of mechanical because it's simple music, or the early rock was, so you knew your
right.
stuff and you just played the stuff and you could do it asleep. But still, you were involved in watching the dancers, and there was a you had to be ready. You couldn't just sleep through it. And that's pretty hard to explain or describe or put in on the page. Unless you do it like Finnegan's Wake, and you can't understand Finnegan's Wake if you bring a normal literate understanding to it. So, for the literate person, Finnegan's Wake fails. But if you know Bob knowledge, it doesn't fail. It actually describes the present, the beginning of the radioelectricity and all that that's happening in the 20s when he's doing the Wake. So, we will see him playing. I'm now going to go to some other quotes.
Okay.
Where he says this again. The point I'm making, he keeps repeating. Let's see. Look at page 116, the bottom paragraph says an unknown tongue is an element.
Yeah, yeah.
He says it again. An unknown tongue, that's tactility, electrified tactility called rock. An unknown tongue is an element of transition which compels structurally and spiritually, that's almost like experientially,
right.
Heraclitean forces or principles of opposition. Tactility is, in a simple definition, contrast. It's the interplay of things, different sensory modalities, made coherent. If you're actually looking at the heart, systole and diastole, the inflow and the outflow, it's very hard to see how it's doing it. You can't visualize. It's just going in and out at the same time. And there are forces going different directions. So the very principles of opposition, which only are known by literate people, and acoustic societies, but acoustic societies are very flexible in their response to setting up a dialectic opposition. Tribal people say, "What are opposites? What is common? What unites opposites?" They'll say, "Oppositeness." But you don't say that in a literate society. It's either black and white. Okay, so the you take any polarities, they have to be flowing back and forth like the systole back and forth like the systole and diastole of the heart to approximate a presentation of tactility. So there he's saying it. The unknown tongue is an element of transition which compels, structurally and spiritually, forces or principles of opposition. Compels them into something that's bigger or a more of a surround. Okay?
Yeah.
Then he says, the best visual representation of this conception of the tongue occurs in the films Hard Day's Night and Help during chase hyperkinetic chase sequences.
Yeah.
Okay, that's... As McLuhan said, as you get more and more a tactile society, a kinetic literate society will more and more get into hyper movement, hyper kineticism. So that in movies today, they're so fast. The imagery, the movement. Young
right.
kids can do it, but older people probably say, "Well, this is too fast. There's no, I don't know what it is. It's just being what they call special effects, just being mowed over." So the chasing begins with these Beatles movies,
right?
The
right.
hyperkineticism, and then the other guys come in Hollywood, and they keep speeding up. They're still speeding it up. Okay, so.